you guys wait to be here. I love what goes on in the Graduate Forum. And do take advantage of the Developing Christian Mind Conference next term. It's unique. They're hoping to make some of what is presented at the BCM Developing Christian Mind to other universities, but at the moment, there's nothing like it in any other university in the world. So while you're here, make use of it. The talk I'm giving you first appeared last May in the Oxbridge Philokalic Review. And I have a half a dozen or so copies, depending on what's a copy of the whole issue number 4 of the Oxbridge Philokalic Review. It's put out by a group of Romanian Orthodox postgrads in Oxford and Cambridge and some other British universities. And their fourth issue, Annunciation 2015, around May, was devoted to to Jerusalem and the New Jerusalem. And one of the editors approached me and said, "Joe, would you write a meditation on the New Jerusalem?" I love the challenge, and so it's there. And the talk is just a slight revision of that. I think it's being recorded, and also I can, if you don't provide a review, I can email you a text. It's very compressed. It was intended to stimulate thinking, not to do all the thinking for you. Just to come to some conclusions and stimulate thinking. And on your handouts, you have the 5 topics, and the quote there under each of the 5 topics is the brief conclusion I came to, and that you will hear me quote at the end of that section of the talk. And afterwards, more than questions, I would like discussion on what relevance you see from the talk and from the teaching in Revelation chapter 21 on the New Jerusalem, that future that God has told us something about. What relevance you see from the talk for your research, your work, and how you might use concepts as a challenge. So, Tertullian's question, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? The church with the academy is well known, and it's often used to highlight anti-intellectualism among Christians. Many in today's Oxbridge, and I'm going to use the terms Oxbridge and academia interchangeably, many in today's Oxbridge and the wider culture betray a similar attitude toward the church. That is, toward any assertion of a transcendent reality outside the competence of natural science. By reversing and updating Tertullian, it can be expressed this way. What does Oxbridge have to do with the New Jerusalem? What does the modern world have to do with ancient religious visions of the future? And my answer is this: more than you might at first think. On the other hand, the negative answer of many may be expressed by a rhetorical rephrasing of the question. What possible relevance can pre-scientific imaginings have for people involved in the study of this work? The art and the literature which those imaginings produced may well command appreciative aesthetic analysis, and religious beliefs themselves, along with other superstitions, may properly be studied by historians and cultural anthropologists and sociologists. But such visions can have no meaning in a scientific search for truth. You and I have to live in the real world of technology and the internet, not of strange visions. And by the way, on the back of your handout is the full text of Revelation 21. I'm sorry, I forgot to include the first five verses of chapter 22. The whole essence is in chapter 22. Indeed, if there is no transcendent creator who cares about the world, if there is no infinite personal God, who is there sustaining and giving meaning to our study of this created order, then the implied answer is sound. None. No relevance whatsoever. But if there really is only chance plus time plus matter in motion, that is, matter in motion until its eventual entropic heat death, then the real question is not simply the relevance of ancient vision. More profoundly, the question is, what is the final value and the meaning of all academic study? Indeed, what is the meaning of all work, of all life in this world? Without a truly transcendent future, without the New Jerusalem, any success in increasing scientific understanding of creating works of art, music, literature, of simply making the world better, is fleeting and tiny in cosmic terms. Woody Allen has said that in order to distract us from the awful truth about the meaninglessness of everything, we need diversions. He was thinking of entertainment. But if nothing we do lasts, then on what basis can Oxford, can academia, can any of us claim that our work is more than our diversion choice? There are those whose worldview allows no place for any non-material reality, for anything which could transcend what their philosophical naturalism can envision. The assertion of Stephen Newton of the National Center for Science Education in America is unambiguous. Quote, "It needs to be said clearly. All educated people understand there are no forces outside. Some of these thinkers, with open honesty, go on to state the future they see implied by their understanding of a purely natural world closed to transcendence. Perhaps the best known expression of this view of humanity's future is that of Bertrand Russell. Quote, "That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand." Or J.W. Sullivan puts it this way, "The vast extent of the universe, both in space and time, is, from the human point of view, completely meaningless, and completely aimless. Those immense lumps of matter in their millions of millions, incessantly pouring out an inconceivably furious energy for millions of years, seem to be completely pointless. For a fleeting moment, man has been permitted to stare at this gigantic and meaningless display. Long before the process comes to an end, man will have vanished from the scene, and the rest of the performance will take place in the unthinkable night of the absence of all consciousness. Arthur Balfour expressed this conclusion in these words: "The energies of our solar system will decay. The glory of the sun will be dimmed, and the earth will no longer tolerate the race which has for a moment disturbed its solitude. Man will go down into the pit, and all his thoughts will perish. The uneasy consciousness which in this obscure corner has for a brief space broken the contented silence of the universe will be forever at rest. Matter will know itself no longer. Imperishable monuments and immortal deeds, death itself and love stronger than death, will be as if they had not been. Nor will anything that is be better or worse for all that the labor, genius, devotion, and suffering of man have striven through countless ages to find." After describing the lateness and brevity of life on Earth, Leslie Cole concludes this way: "The lonely planet will cool, all life will die, all mind will cease, and it will be as if it had never been. It never happened. That, to be honest, is the goal to which evolution is traveling. That is the benevolent end of the furious living and furious dying. All life is no more than a match struck in the dark and blown out. The final result is to deprive it completely of meaning." Another quote I've come across more recently from Jacques Monod's book, Chance and Necessity: "Man must at last wake out of his millenary dream." I like that quote, "millenary dream," because it has to do with the futures, millennial hopes. "Man must at last wake out of his millennial dream and discover his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. He must realize that like a gypsy, he lives on the boundary of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his sufferings or his crimes." Those in academia and elsewhere who do not limit their worldview in this way, but who believe in an infinite personal God who creates, who cares, who acts, and who can speak and has spoken, do not need to be shut up with this kind of pessimism. For such people, the New Jerusalem is not at all an ancient irrelevance, a millenary dream. It is an encouragement to anyone willing to listen that there is a different narrative, a narrative within which our study and all our work does have final meaning. Our lives of research are not just a fleeting moment to stare at this meaningless display, or a match struck in the dark and blown out. A life lived for the glory of God, in fact, all of the work that we do for the glory of God, has significance beyond our own small place in this world. Our work done before the infinite personal God is far from merely a brief space for an uneasy consciousness to break the contented silence of the universe, and to find a way forever at rest, and I will know itself. The Church teaches from the Bible a different narrative. This different narrative frames our present existence within a meaningful past and a divine future. No study limited to this world could ever predict that future. But the God who speaks has revealed it to us. The beautiful thing about the vision of the New Jerusalem granted in the Revelation to St. John is not only that it promises fulfillment of God's purposes in the future, but also it gives meaning to all that we may do now. All our work, our research, all of our lives. The pursuit of knowledge of this world that academia engages in has significance and value now and forever. It has significance and value by being related to the infinite reference point of the Creator God, and because it is done in accordance with God's creative purpose for people to rule and care for the world. And then, the next slide, conclusion of this part. The effort to bring about human flourishing through education, medicine, and just government, through all the arts, through individual integrity in business, through individual acts of caring or charity, all of these are important in God's eyes and will be caught up in the consummation of divine purpose for which the New Jerusalem can serve us as a shorthand. There's a tendency to trust in no future except that of our own construction. With no eternal in view and no one who can speak from outside our limited existence, chance and change must always trump ideas of order and purpose. Let us, as Christians, be willing to look at this ancient religious vision without that kind of constraint, in order to gain the perspective which it has to offer us, not only to Oxford, but to everyone. The account of the New Jerusalem is found in Revelation chapter 21, verse 1 through 22. You have it on the back. I think I'm going to take that. Except for five verses in chapter. I won't be reading it all this part. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. There was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look! God's dwelling place is now among the people, and He will dwell with them. They will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all of this, and and I will be their God, and they will be my children. And it continues, I'm not sure how far down the verse. One of the seven angels came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And that's where I'll close our reading and have the rest of the time. Now, there are some aspects of the description of the New Jerusalem which was especially meaningful to readers in the first century who were undergoing persecution, and also especially relevant to persecuted believers in our world today. Other aspects will be meaningful to believers in any age. And there may well be some aspects to which 21st century believers in academia, all believers will thrill to the description of the New Jerusalem, the holy city, under the following headings. And then, all right. You see the five. One, God's dwelling space. Two, immense in size. Three, Sacrateria, strong and secure. Four, cured from evil or falsehood. And five, so difficult, even as part of a new heaven and a new earth. All right, so number one, kingdom steps. And that conclusion is what I'll come to at the end of this part one on God's dwelling. God's dwelling place. The holy city is not the residence of redeemed and renewed humanity. The holy city is redeemed humanity, the bride of Christ, the people of God. It's not referring to the place, it is referring to the. This is not only explicitly said, but it is also implied by the description of the city as a perfect cube. That was the shape of the innermost part of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, the most holy place where God's presence dwelled with his people, Israel. The residence in the Jewish holy temple, and then inside the dwelling place of redeemed humanity, now is the entire new earth. Redeemed humanity are themselves the place where God dwells. Not as the innermost part of a physical building, but rather within the whole church, the body of Christ, in perfect fellowship with the incarnate Redeemer God, like a bride is with a husband. This means that the limited self-transcendence, which is seen both in science and in the arts, finds its ground and coherence in personal communion with the ultimate transcendence of God. As Princeton Seminary professor James Loder says of the human spirit, quote, "It is not an accident doomed to wander aimlessly in the universe, aimlessly crying out, 'Why?' In the still darkness of empty space. Our spirit's inner logic, its creative drive to construct coherence and remain open to ultimacy, its irrepressible self-transcendence, and its transformational potential, its revulsion at confusion, and its discovery of order and chaos, all these point beyond itself. Loder continues. So what is called for is one who is infinitely conscious, intelligent, and infinitely creative, whose very presence brings order out of chaos and continually restores the spirit to itself as spirit. So, with the new Jerusalem and the new earth, not just the new Jerusalem, but the whole new earth, as God's dwelling place, such presence of the infinite personal God is what the new humanity, the new Jerusalem, will have, fulfilling not only our spiritual longings, but also providing that ultimate ground for all of science and art, which academia, which Oxbridge, by itself, cannot do. Next, immense in size. The dimensions of the cubit city, 12,000 stadia in length, 12,000 stadia in width, and 12,000 stadia in height, is pointless to translate from stadia into kilometers or miles or any other measure. The measurement is not physical or literal. It is meant to express completeness and immense fullness by combining two figures, each of which have symbolic meaning. 12 often stands for a complete whole, as seen in 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles, or 12 months of the year. 1,000 typically means very large. Combined in the city's measurements, we find this. By adding the 12 edges of the cube, with each edge being 12,000 stadia, we get a figure of 144,000. This number appears earlier in the book of the Revelation to refer to the redeemed and also to the words, a great multitude. Conclusion? When we're discouraged by seeming to be a tiny, tiny minority in Oxbridge, academia, or the world, we should take heart. The full scope of God's final redemption is beyond our present numbering or imagination. Section 3. Strong and secure. The immense security of the New Jerusalem is signified by a great high wall around the city. The wall not only is 144 cubits thick, note the multiplication of 12 by 12, it also has 12 foundations. Even further, there's an angel standing guard at each of 12. It's hard to imagine a fuller image of security than a wall, and I will translate it into terms, of 70 meters thick, with an angel standing guard at each gate. But then, John goes on to say that the gates will never need to be shut. What more dramatic a statement of security could there be? In this present world, science and technology are co-opted for conflict, co-opted for aggression, as well as for protection. While the arts are co-opted for propaganda. Furthermore, war itself raises questions of the relevance of academic study. C.S. Lewis found it necessary to address this important question of learning in wartime in a sermon that he gave in Oxford in early of World War II.
learning and growth.
Conclusion. Should not the promise of security inspire and challenge us even now to use our study and research for peace, for conflict resolution, and for healing? New heaven and new earth and the new Jerusalem will be pure from evil or falsehood. Quote, nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful. This city, the redeemed, will be a wholesomely purified people. This means that in human terms, that there will be none of the jealousies, the pride, the self-advancement, the competition, the dishonesty, the misuse of position to dominate, or any of the temptations to which Oxbridge, academia, business, and indeed every human organization, including churches, now are subject. What a model for believers to seek to follow now in Oxford, in academia, in business, in government, in all human endeavors and relationships today. Today we struggle with idolatries and false ideologies. They deceive us and confuse us in our attempt to understand the immense cosmos and this amazing world we inhabit within. They tempt us to lower our standards of honesty and fairness, discussion and public engagement, and private argument. Conclusion. Cannot we take inspiration from a future world of truth to seek to be wholly truthful in presenting our work and fair in discussion or in critique of the work of others? Fine. Showing continuity even as part of a new heaven and a new earth. The setting in which the New Jerusalem is introduced is that of a new heaven and a new earth. This renewed creation, the whole new earth, rather than just the city itself, is the living and working space of God's redeemed people. We have seen that the city represents them, the people, rather than being just a location where they live on the new earth. The whole new earth is these things which the redeemed people will inherit. We are told that certain things will be given to these peoples on the new earth. Quote, the nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. The splendor of the kings of the earth and the glory and honor of the nations must be about far more than any material wealth, which may rightly have encouraged the first century. This is a redeemed mankind on a new earth. A new earth. Without the hindrance of being people estranged from God on a world broken by rebellion, they can now fulfill the creation mandate given originally to mankind to subdue, fill, and care for the earth. But this will be neither a return to the beginning nor a starting over again from scratch. I believe that splendor, glory, and honor indicate that all that is best from this present earth will be brought into the city. The best of what had been done in fulfillment of the task to subdue, fill, cultivate the earth. The best of what had been done in fulfillment of that task will be there in the new heaven and the new earth. Even though everything was tainted and distorted by sin, it will be purified and brought to God's purified people to perfect and to extend. We need to go on. All that is best in culture, in art, in music, in drama, and in literature will be there. All that is valid in science, all that is useful in engineering, and all that is true in historical study will be. Every story of kindness, every story of a life lived with love and faithful, no matter how obscure and unknown that story was, every such story will be gathered like even though the greatness of much literature and art is derived from sinful themes, as too is historical writing, purified people will be able to hear and read without being tempted to sin. They will be able to perceive that literature and written history without being tempted to sin. They will be able to perceive it as showing the goodness and kindness of God's amazing grace to redeem people from such a rebellious, broken world. The beauty which we can see and hear and create now are only a shadow of what will be seen and heard and created in the new world. That which is best from every culture, from every tribe, from every language, from every people, from every nation, will be there. Study and learning, if true, reveal the reality which God already knows. So study helps us see the world the way God already sees it, as it truly is. While this is so to some extent now, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Final conclusion. All in the new earth will participate in this work. We will have work. Even now, however, as I think of the investigation that goes on in Oxford, of the worlds of nature and of society, I think this is part of what God made humankind to do. It is not perfect, but neither is it all destined to become nothing. God will preserve it and perfect it along with the New Jerusalem. I long that many in academia might come to realize this, to praise God, and so rejoice before Him in their work in this world. In this world is not yet seen its transformation. Even so, let us take heart and do our work with the confidence that it is worthwhile both in the present and for eternity.
Right. Thank you,
Julian. I'm sorry, give you something to think about.
Yeah, perfect. And you're good with the quirky questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Questions. And I hope there will be discussion of the same, and some ideas of how can I now do my work in such a way that reflects that truth, right? God's future.
Okay. Now that you've got given us lots to think about, and something obviously coming out of years of personal experience with things, and
as I say, curious, the original at £3 and one copy of Philokalic,
right,
means love of the good or love of excellence. Now there's £3 if you have, and if you just want a copy of the talk emailed to you, then give you an address.
Excellent. So one question I had for you was about just your own personal experience, because I know from one of the bios I looked at in preparing the intro, that you came yourself out of a, I think you described it as a soft atheism, into Christian belief. And I was wondering to what degree that was an intellectual journey, or if that was coming out of sort of, it was more, there are other factors involved, or what sort of what led you from one thing, which is obviously a perspective that might have had more resonance with the quotes that you kind of were reading earlier in the talk, and then to obviously a perspective that's a lot more aligned with this New Jerusalem idea.
Right. That's why I grew up in Sunday school. Once started junior high school, youth fellowship in junior high school. I can't remember when I wasn't taken to Sunday school. And that was my whole background. I arrived at Harvard as an undergraduate, and it just fell away. I didn't become a hard atheist like Dawkins. I became a soft atheist. I don't believe that stuff anymore. So there was a Christian guy who lived across the hall who, because in bull sessions, now you don't know the term bull session, do you? Bull session was what we called our conversation debates in the dormitories, halls of residence that went on into the wee hours of the morning, where we talked about the meaning of life and everything around bull sessions, because we were swinging the bull. In bull sessions, because of my church and basically Christian background, I defended various Christian moral points of view. So this Christian guy who lived across the hall, from that assumed I was a Christian and would be interested in the Harvard Christian Fellowship, to the equivalent of the Oxford Christian Union, OICU. But I wasn't. But God has a great sense of humor. I didn't go to any of the Harvard Christian Fellowship meetings, but at the end of November, the last football game of the American college football season is the Harvard-Yale game. Now, the Harvard-Yale American football game has the same status there as the Oxford-Cambridge boat race has here. The Oxford-Cambridge boat race is just called the boat race. And it is typically called the game. Well, in odd years, it's at Yale, and in even years, it's at Harvard. This was November of 1951, an odd year, so it was down at Yale. In order to get a ride, this is God's sense of humor, in order to get a ride down to the Harvard-Yale game, I went in a carload with some Harvard Christian Fellowship guys. And we went down on Friday before the game, which was on Saturday afternoon. Well, in the evening, the Yale Christian Fellowship put on a dinner for the Harvard Christian Fellowship. Now, I had to eat someplace. It was only polite for me to go along to their dinner, and it was free. So I went along to the joint Harvard-Yale Christian Fellowship's dinner. And God used the reality of what the speaker talked about to just finish my soft atheism. It wasn't a huge intellectual thing, because there wasn't any huge intellectual problem that I had suddenly got at Harvard. Just to make it, what is it? The speaker was an Irish Quaker missionary to Japan, Miss Irene Webster Smith. And she talked about her work with orphans in Japan. And after, she was in Japan between the two World Wars and then returned to Japan after the war, where she helped start InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, the equivalent of UCCF, in Japan. And part of her talk was also her getting to speak individually to some of the condemned Japanese war criminals. You've all probably heard about the Nuremberg trials that tried and convicted various Germans of war crimes in World War II, where there were similar trials in Japan that are not as well known. And I'm not sure. Something between a dozen and two dozen men were condemned to be killed, to be executed. Irene Webster Smith, whom all the Japanese called sensei, so I'll use the name sensei, is Japanese for teacher, had led the wife of one of the condemned war criminals to Christ. And this wife said, "Sensei, would you please go and talk with my husband in prison about Christ?" So Sensei applied and was told only relatives were allowed to visit these condemned criminals, and that only once a month. So the wife said, "Well, I will give up my place for you to visit." Answer, "No, only relatives." So, Irene Webster Smith, good strong Irish woman, yes, she was, went straight to the top, to General Douglas MacArthur, who was head of all of the Allied occupation forces in all of Japan, and appealed to him to be allowed to speak to this condemned war criminal, and he gave her permission. So, she spoke with him, told him about Christ, told him about God's forgiveness, which is available no matter what we have done, no matter how terrible our cruelty and our crimes. And she led him to Christ. And she said to him, "You must tell someone else about this step that you've just taken of believing in Christ." He said, "Well, I'm in solitary confinement. I'm not allowed to talk with anyone." "Don't you ever see anyone?" "Yes, once a day we are allowed to walk for an hour in the prison courtyard, and it's possible to talk with the other condemned prisoners then." She said, "We'll talk with one." So he did. And this man then said, "Please, I would like to talk to that lady." So she got permission. And for another one. And for another one, I think she led nine of those condemned war criminals to faith in Christ before they were executed. And one day, as she was leaving from having been speaking with a prisoner, the American sergeant, the American Army officer who was letting her in and out, said to her, "What are you telling these men? They are all so different since you've been talking to them. What are you telling them?" So she told him, led him to Christ. But it was the sheer reality that convinced me, and it brought me back to belief. And I'm being very careful in my use of words. It brought me back to belief. And so I joined the Harvard Christian Fellowship, and it was so tiny in those days that at the end of my freshman year, I was one of the executive committee of four people who were so hard up for leaders. And I had learned how to pray out loud, I could lead Bible studies, I could discuss theology. But coming back to belief was the beginning of a process. It took 8 months for that belief to become personal faith. That's a different story that happened at a training camp in Canada the following summer for Christian student leaders that I worked with for a month.
Well, Canada's a good place for stuff like that.
Lake of Bays in Ontario, about 100 miles north of Toronto. Thankful to God for that.
Passion. Any other questions for Joe?
What can I ask you? Do you find encouragement from what I have, the conclusions I've drawn from meditating on New Jerusalem?
Yeah.
There is an anti-intellectualism among many Christians which treats academic work and science and anything that isn't direct church work as simply marking time and being able to earn money to support Christian workers. And I think that point of view is completely against what the Bible teaches.
I agree. So, last chance for a question, although we will still be around, so we'll have a chance to also talk to Joe in person. So any other ones from the group? Rob?
Yes. Just something I was thinking about as you were talking was that I liked your, I guess, what I feel like it's such an important picture of the good or the best of this world being sort of taken up into the city or into consummation. Thinking about study, I guess there are different kinds of study, and it's that picture fits well with kind of discovering something good in creation or something good that God's made or some easy to praise sort of human production, human culture. I wonder about so some of my own writing for my doctoral thesis focused on sort of a kind of critique of immigration governance, immigration law, largely sort of unmasking what I felt like were overreaching power claims or distortions of the truth. So there might be times in studies to sort of to point out falsehood or error or injustice or oppression, that sort of thing. And it's somehow, maybe that's in different categories, eventually that's sort of sloughed off and thrown away. I wonder if,
Yeah.
And it becomes speculative. We begin to wonder: Do we remember? Are there histories taken up into the?
I think history will be,
but of course.
You've mentioned something that I left out completely, and that is the practical good that can come from some of our studying research. And so, what you're talking about, the study of immigration laws and the ways they work well and the ways that they work unfairly, that has present implications now to give glory to God by improving the lot of immigrants within the world. So I didn't mention that, but thank you for bringing it up. That's very important that what we do has a lot of practical, or may have a lot of practical work now. As far as in the future, I would say it would be some aspect of human history that would be studying. And as I said, I can't see gems and gold and silver and all that being the treasure of the nations. The only treasure the nations makes any sense to me is
what we've done in studied science, art, music, literature, all that sort of thing. And as I thought about literature, and most of literature is based on sinful things. That's the reality of the whole world. And history, most of history, is based upon the evils and cruelty as well as the good that's been done in history. And I thought, well, yes, we'll be able to appreciate them, but with minds that have been purified, we'll be able to appreciate the literary value and the historical study and value, and not be tempted by the sinful means.
Anything else?
I think it was a really good talk, especially coming into eighth week, and when we all need encouragement, for sure, I think, to keep going. So, thank you very much, Joe.
Well, you have my conclusions there, and if you want the whole thing, just give me a legible version of your email address.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Great, well, let's thank Joe again.